This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, September 27th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Tuesday, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced the start of a formal impeachment inquiry against President Trump, saying that he had betrayed his oath of office, the nation's security, and the integrity of U.S. elections. She said, "The actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution, and that Trump must be held accountable. No one," she said, "is above the law." Pelosi acted after learning that the executive branch was withholding from Congress an urgent whistleblower's complaint, said to allege that Trump had pressured Ukraine's new president, Vladimir Zelensky, to investigate Joe Biden, a chief rival in the 2020 election, and Biden's son, Hunter, for purportedly corrupt dealings in Ukraine. On Wednesday, the White House released a summary of the now-notorious July 25th phone call between Trump and Zelensky. In a press conference, Adam Schiff, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, vividly characterized the call.
The president communicates to his Ukrainian counterpart that the United States has done a lot for Ukraine. We've done an awful lot for Ukraine, more than the Europeans or anyone else has done for Ukraine. But there's not much reciprocity here. This is how a mafia boss talks. What have you done for us? We've done so much for you, but there's not much reciprocity. I have a favor I want to ask you. What is that favor? Of course, the favor is to investigate his political rival, to investigate the Bidens.
Yesterday, the whistleblower's complaint was publicly released. It conveys in dramatic detail a pattern of apparent malfeasance by Trump and his key advisors. The whistleblower asserts, "I have received information from multiple U.S. government officials that the President of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 U.S. election." The complaint describes Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, as a central figure in this effort and says that Attorney General Barr appears to be involved as well. Jane Mayer, David Rode, and Jeffrey Toobin, who report for The New Yorker on the Trump administration, join me to discuss how Giuliani, Vice President Mike Pence, and Barr appear to have assisted Trump in his efforts to convince a foreign power to help him in his reelection efforts. Jeff, I want to start with you. You are writing a book about the Mueller investigation, and you've published pieces for The New Yorker about Giuliani and about Schiff, for that matter. So I turn to you first for a little legal and political context. Trump thought he was vindicated by Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. So maybe you could compare for us briefly Mueller's conclusions and what the whistleblower has now outlined about the administration's actions to tip the 2020 election.
Well, Dorothy, as my dad used to say, to make a long story unbearable, the Mueller investigation had two parts. The first part involved the dealings of the Trump campaign with Russian interests and the question of whether the Trump campaign solicited or encouraged or participated in the clear Russian efforts to help him win the election. And the conclusion of that was that the Trump forces were receptive, but there was actually no meeting of the minds between them. The other part of the Mueller report was whether there was obstruction of justice. Did Trump and his administration make efforts to stop both Mueller's own investigation and other investigations of what really went on? Rudy Giuliani was the president's personal attorney and frequent television spokesman, and he has always been very interested in this question of, did Joe Biden collude, in effect, with the Ukraine when he was vice president of the United States and his son was a businessman with interest in Ukraine? And what happened in the last week is that we learned that the president of the United States, when it was Trump, had this extraordinary conversation with the president of Ukraine. What came out in the whistleblower's complaint is that, according to the whistleblower, people in the White House were so panicked about this inappropriate, if not illegal, phone call, that there was some effort to hide the documentation of that phone call. And that's sort of where we are now.
Okay. So just a little bit more on Giuliani. Initially, we know he wanted to be named Secretary of State. That didn't happen. But after he became Trump's personal lawyer, I believe it was in the spring of 2018, he went ahead and aggressively inserted himself into foreign affairs in any case. So it seems to me that his actions have emerged as a kind of template for how the administration likes to conduct diplomacy.
It's hesitant to think of anything this administration does as like a pattern because it all seems so sort of haphazard and random. But it is true that there is this sort of improvisational effort, whether it is Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and advisor, you know, conducting major parts of foreign policy. But at least he is a government employee at this point. What makes the Giuliani thing so extraordinary and possibly inappropriate, if not illegal, is that he doesn't work for the government at all. He is the president's personal lawyer. And why he has any business or authority to deal with foreign governments on behalf of the president or behalf of the U.S. government is very much an open question, and I think at the heart of this continuing investigation.
And then when you look at the timeline, so we know from the Washington Post that in mid-July, Trump ordered his chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, to withhold $400 million in military aid to Ukraine that Congress had already approved. Trump's call with Zelensky occurred on July 25th. After the call, Giuliani flew to Madrid and met with an aide to Zelensky, who later said that Giuliani told him, "Your country owes it to us and your country to find out what really happened." What was he talking about? What was going on there?
Well, we don't know for sure, but the clear implication is that Giuliani is trying to leverage the relationship between the United States and Ukraine. And just what Giuliani appears to be doing is a version of what Trump was doing in that phone call, which is saying, if you want our aid, you have to come across with dirt on Joe Biden's family.
So Trump and Rudy Giuliani, and Jane, feel free to jump in here if you would like to as well. They wanted to convince American voters. There's this whole sort of two conspiracy theories, it seems, and one of which is that Hillary Clinton and Ukraine conspired to defeat him in 2016. Do I have that right?
It's a crazy conspiracy theory, really. But the one involving 2016 was that Ukraine has Hillary Clinton's emails, supposedly. And the conspiracy theory holds that it was Ukrainians rather than Russia that hacked into her emails. It's a theory that, of course, the Russians like. And so there have been a lot of Russian bots that have pushed it and a lot of sort of alt-right websites that have pushed it. And kind of amazingly, it's been picked up and adopted by even sort of more major news organizations on the right.
And then there's the theory about Joe and Hunter Biden. And how much credibility, if any, is there in their theory about that corruption with Ukraine?
Well, if you look at it closely, it seems that what you will find is that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, did take a very lucrative job with the largest gas company in the Ukraine, and that it happened while his father was Vice President Biden, was overseeing sort of relations with Ukraine. And so it's not an optimal situation. In fact, it seems sort of sleazy on the face of it. But beyond that, there's no illegality that's been proven. There was an effort to make it look like a prosecutor was pushed out by Vice President Biden, and that just does not hold up. It appears that the right-wing media sphere went with stories that were based on the word of a Ukrainian former prosecutor named Yuri Lutsenko, And this man, Lutsenko, later came out and said actually he had no evidence to back up these conspiracy theories. But by then, sort of, it had become kind of a folklore in the right that there was some kind of deep, dark scandal here. But there doesn't appear to be any evidentiary basis for it.
Yeah, and we should mention Adam Entus's excellent piece on Hunter Biden for The New Yorker, which really kind of goes through all of this at some length. So, Jeff, before I leave you temporarily, what laws might Giuliani be violating with the actions he's taken in Ukraine?
Well, it's very hard to tell. I mean, I actually think the issue in this part of the investigation is so much about presidential misconduct and presidential misuse of office that is much more the core of this investigation. I'm not sure what laws Rudy Giuliani would have violated. I don't think he obstructed justice. I don't think he tampered with witnesses. There are certain laws about negotiating with other countries, like the Logan Act, but that's never going to be prosecuted, and that's not really what's going on here.
No campaign and finance.
Well, I mean, I suppose it is, you know, one theory of he was recruiting campaign contributions in kind. I find that somewhat of a stretch. I think this whole Ukraine chapter is much more about impeachment than it is any sort of criminal offense.
So, Jane, let's turn to Vice President Mike Pence. You wrote a piece about him 2 years ago called The Danger of President Pence. He is considered by many to be perhaps the greatest sycophant of all in Trump's orbit. At the first full cabinet meeting, he announced that it was the greatest privilege of his life to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people. But he operates by stealth, not by bombast and by peddling conspiracy theories the way Giuliani does. What power does he hold in the White House?
Well, I mean, he's been described as kind of a zealot figure. He's kind of there on the edges, but he's very important to Trump in that he is the outreach to two key elements in Trump's support base. One is to the religious right, and the other is to the big business right, the Koch brothers network and other sort of major corporate funders. So he's important to them, and he kind of, you know, in his Boy Scout looking way, sort of conveys a kind of a seal of good housekeeping to Trump that Trump really needs. So it's not surprising that Trump said this week, go ask Mike Pence. You know, he had some phone calls with the Ukrainians, too. He was sort of either throwing them under the bus or, I think, really trying to get some cover from Mike Pence. And Pence is, in fact, implicated in this in various interesting ways. We don't know the whole story yet. Pence was not on the sort of notorious phone call on July 25th. He could have been, but he was interestingly absent from that call. But he was going to meet with the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, himself. He was invited to the inauguration on May 20th, and what appeared to be a vice presidential trip in the making was canceled on May 14th.
By Trump himself?
By Trump himself. According to the whistleblower's complaint, the president asked him to cancel the trip in order to get, again, what looks like leverage over Zelensky. And Pence did, in fact, cancel that trip. And there are there's a phone call, and there's also an in-person meeting later in September between Pence and the president of Ukraine, in which they did discuss what Pence has said is corruption. So though Pence's people have said they didn't specifically discuss Biden, but you see him right there being kind of dragged into this or willingly being part of it. It's hard to tell which, but, you know, almost nobody survives working with Trump without getting in trouble.
Speaking of which, I want to go back in time a little bit to when Trump selected Pence as his vice presidential nominee. Wasn't it Paul Manafort, then Trump's campaign manager or chairman, who orchestrated that pick?
It was indeed.
And then Manafort had his own Ukrainian links.
Exactly. He took in millions from the Russian-aligned leadership in Ukraine. And that all came out. And that when that came out, he had to resign. It was a scandal. And now it's been, you know, proven a crime.
So, Jane, we all know Trump has forced the resignation of dozens at this point of top officials, most recently National Security Advisor John Bolton, who opposed the outsourcing of the Ukrainian relationship to Giuliani. Pence is the only member of the cabinet who can't be fired. But how vulnerable is he now as the impeachment inquiry moves forward?
There was a good quote in the Washington Post from Michael Steele, who's a political consultant, who said that Mike Pence wears asbestos underwear. He's right next to the fire, but so far he hasn't been burned. I think that, you know, the question everybody's got is how long can he keep from bursting into flames himself? I mean, when you look back at Clinton's impeachment, that scandal eventually really hurt Al Gore. You look back at Nixon, and of course, Spiro Agnew was convicted. Slightly separate scandal. So it's very hard to be vice president to a president who's involved in huge scandals without it smearing your own reputation.
Not to mention the attorney general, which brings us to you, David Rode. Barr has turned out to be another key figure in this drama. You are writing a book about the Trump administration, and one official you write about at some length is Bill Barr. Who appears in the phone call summary. Trump says he's going to have Barr get in touch with Zelensky about the Bidens. And the whistleblower's complaint says that Barr appears to be involved in soliciting foreign interference in the 2020 elections. Let's start by asking, how did Barr respond when that phone call went public?
So the interesting thing here is that Barr denied that any of this had happened. He said that President Trump never asked him to speak to Ukrainian officials. Barr said he never spoke to Giuliani about the Ukraine, and he, you know, it was a very forceful and broad denial that Barr played no role whatsoever in this whole scandal. But there is a problem with Barr and the bigger one, which is that, you know, when the whistleblower complaint kind of makes its way up the chain, eventually intelligence officials, you know, go to the Justice Department for an opinion about this. And the Office of Legal Counsel, Jeff will know this better than me, came out with an opinion that this whistleblower complaint, which it clearly says in the law should go to Congress, to the separate branch of government, you know, to monitor the executive branch, the OLC under Barr said no. They blocked the transfer of the whistleblower complaint, which is an extraordinary act.
And what transpired yesterday in McGuire's testimony, the acting director of National Intelligence?
He basically, there was sort of a debate. Democrats said, McGuire, you shouldn't have asked the OLC and the White House for permission to send this on. You should have sent it straight to Congress. I talked to former intelligence officials. They felt that McGuire was in a very difficult position. There are all kinds of whistleblower complaints. This law has been around. It was introduced by Republicans. It's been around for decades. They appear every month or two. This is completely unprecedented. There's never been a whistleblower complaint from an intelligence official alleging criminal conduct by the sitting president of the United States. So intelligence officials feel McGuire sort of did do the right thing. He was in an impossible position. And the fault here lies with the White House and Barr for not allowing him to forward the complaint.
Although, if I can just add something, I mean, there's a certain air of unreality about, you know, the criticism on this issue about, you know, how early these documents should have been turned over, because they have been turned over. The idea that, you know, he should be criticized for not turning something over that has already been turned over seemed a little silly to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think McGuire's done everyone I've talked to who knows him and has worked with him says he was in a very difficult position. He's done the right thing. He was very forceful yesterday saying, I'm a public servant. I'm not partisan, you know, trying not to get caught up in this. And where the system did work was, you know, Trump turned this over because he was threatened by Congress, the co-equal branch of government, with its ultimate penalty, impeachment. And then he quickly released the telephone transcript and then quickly released the whistleblower complaint. But I agree with you, Jeff. McGuire, that wasn't the issue. The issue is Donald Trump, as actually you've been saying, Jeff.
Interestingly, Vice President Pence argued against releasing the transcript of the, you know, so-called transcript of the phone call because he thought it would set a bad precedent. But I also, you have to wonder if he didn't look at it and see that it could be, you know, quite incriminating looking. And apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, Trump argued in favor of putting it out because he felt he'd lost control of the message. He realized that the public was turning on him, and he thought that by releasing it, he could try to get, in control again of the message.
And that turns out to have been a miscalculation, to say the least.
An incredible miscalculation, I think.
Why did they release that transcript? I mean, this is a White House that has fought the disclosure of absolutely everything, including much, very, very bland and unincriminating documents. Here, you have a document that is perhaps an impeachable offense in and of itself. Why did they release it?
One theory is that Trump is in such a bubble himself that he didn't recognize how incriminating it was, and that he lives in a world of sort of transactional politics where, everybody has a price and this is how you wheel and deal. And he has said publicly, if someone has dirt from another country, sure, I'd take it. This has kind of been out there he does not recognize that there's a line you shouldn't cross.
And again, to get back to a point we were making earlier, he thought he was vindicated by the Mueller report. He thinks he can wriggle his way out of any situation.
And I've talked to, current and former Trump administration officials who've spent hundreds of hours with him. And what you're saying, Jane, is right. He kind of operates like a New York real estate developer. So he assumes everybody has an angle. Everybody's kind of distorting the truth. Everybody's looking for advantage here. He did think he could shift the narrative. And I agree, Jeff, this was a monumental mistake. And this kind of goes back to Barr. It's amazing. It's unprecedented. The amount of obstruction overall from the White House in terms of congressional efforts, to get documents. The six House committees that are trying to investigate things across the administration, flat out, no one will testify in terms of, the Mueller report, the president's tax returns. The law says they shall be turned over to the House committee. Again, the White House, with the support of Barr and the Justice Department, no, we're not going to turn that over. And so it was a very strange thing that this call transcript was released.
And this worked very well for them, by the way, until this week.
Well, and one more point that I think is worth considering is that the people who surrounded Trump in earlier parts of this administration who were able to say no and who had the presence of mind to say no have pretty much disappeared from the scene inside the White House. So you don't have a chief of staff now who is going to stand up to Trump. And you had people in the White House, according to the whistleblower complaint, many of them who recognized this is a huge problem. And that seems to be why they stuck this, tried to deep six it inside that classified server. But you don't have people around Trump telling him this is a really bad idea.
Now, if I can just sort of look ahead on one point, which I think is worth keeping an eye on, is the big new disclosure that came out in the whistleblower complaint was this apparent conspiracy to hide information about the phone call with the president of Ukraine, putting it in some classified form that it shouldn't be. If the Intelligence Committee wants to pursue that, I think they are going to have a terribly difficult time getting any witnesses or physical evidence out of the White House on it. I think the White House will return to its Stonewall mode, and I just wonder if they will be able to get any proof other than the words of the whistleblower to substantiate that very significant part of what he said.
Is that because it's the lawyers? I mean, according to the whistleblower, it was actually the lawyers in the White House who went along with that. Is that because they would never testify?
That's because they would never be allowed.
And does that include Giuliani?
Well, I mean, Giuliani's somewhat of a separate case because Giuliani's not a government employee, and he doesn't work for the White House. Now, he is the personal lawyer. He certainly couldn't be forced to testify about his conversations with the president, but I don't see why he couldn't be forced to testify about his conversations with the State Department and with Ukrainians. But as for this classification issue, seems to be only government employees and White House and NSC employees who were involved with it. And I just have to believe that just as they have prevented Don McGahn from testifying about his time as a White House lawyer, they're not going to let anyone else testify about their time as a White House lawyer.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Everybody's talking now about a cover-up in relation to this moving of the documents, and it sounds like there are others in that vault, electronic vault, that may be incriminating too. In the past, we know cover-ups have led to the downfall of presidents. So you don't think that that is going to factor into this in a big way?
Well, I do think it's highly significant and worth investigating. I'm just going on the basis of how the Trump administration has behaved so far. They haven't been able to penetrate the White House, these investigations.
They need a John Dean, right?
They need, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. They need someone inside the White House to say, I can't do this anymore.
But wait a minute, Jane. I agree, Jeff, but we could tell from the whistleblower report that there are a number of people inside the White House who are really disturbed about what's going on. Is it out of the question that one of them will come forward?
No, I don't think so. You know, the challenge will be sort of smoking them out and getting them to testify.
I had a long conversation with a current White House official. This was before all the story broke. And the person admitted that the president was damaged, that the president lied to people. But this person really supported the president's policies. And so they were saying that kind of the criticism and the talk of illegality was all exaggerated. We all rationalize why we do things, but it was fascinating to sort of, I'm not working for Donald Trump. I know he's a flawed person, but I'm working for the voters who elected him, the middle class.
But that won't work anymore. I think you should go back to that source.
I'm trying.
And find out what he or she says now.
And Jeff, I had a former intelligence official say to me this morning, it depends on sort of the intent of why they moved these documents or these recordings into this, you know, more secure system. And that if they didn't want it to leak, that's one thing. But if the intent was by these lawyers to somehow cover up criminal misconduct, that's different. And aren't we, you know, approaching a sort of an issue where Congress is demanding these documents and records for their impeachment inquiry, the White House refuses to do it, and we're back to the Nixon White House tapes and the Supreme Court?
We are. I mean, certainly the legal issue is there. But again, keep in mind the practical aspects of this. Let's say there is a court fight over access to some of this information, which I think is very likely. Nancy Pelosi has said she wants this wrapped up by the end of the year, if not sooner. There is basically no way a court fight over access to White House information, witnesses, documents, could be resolved before next spring. I mean, once you're in court, delay is inevitable, even if you wind up winning.
All right. I want to go back to you, David. You wrote this week on NewYorker.com that the constitutional system of checks and balances and the Watergate reforms imposed to further rein in a wayward president actually have worked so far in this case. Could you talk a little bit about that and sort of how you expect that to play out?
I think it's worked that the threat of impeachment this week caused the president to release this very damaging transcript of the phone call. I think it, you know, worked then in terms of releasing the whistleblower complaint. But I agree with Jeff, there's a really rough road ahead. And if we're talking about no court decision till the spring, it's not clear where the Supreme Court, you know, would go on this issue.
And just in the spring, they're going to be primaries. It seems like that has practical and political problems.
And that's why Pelosi had been so reluctant.
And that's why she's pushing such a fast schedule. But the schedule will not be under her control entirely.
And legally, Jeff, I mean, it was a 9-0 decision under Nixon. Do you have any guess at where this court would go?
Oh, I think it's a very different scenario. I mean, this court is deeply political. I would not even hazard a guess as to what how that would come out. But the one thing that's for sure when you're involving the United States Supreme Court is they operate on their own schedule, not on the political calendar.
So I have a question for any of you or all of you. No administration has been more successful in obfuscation and spreading lies and disinformation than Trump's. We've already seen Trump on Twitter. He's perhaps engaging in what could be judged to be witness intimidation by threatening the whistleblower and his sources, saying, "We used to handle spies and treason a little differently than we do now." Jeff, where is Giuliani in this? Is he up to his old tricks?
Giuliani's behavior has been so, just crazy and unhinged. I think he has changed. I mean, even since last year, where, he did a lot of good legal work for the president in the Mueller investigation. I mean, don't kid yourself. I think he now looks like an exaggerated version of himself. I think he's really unhinged. And, he has not helped his client. It does appear that he's been ginning up the president, to pursue this whole Ukrainian thing, and it may get the president impeached.
And the president himself, an older, addled man who is very susceptible to this kind of thing, in fact, enjoys it.
Well, and their peers. I mean, one of the things that was interesting when I was reporting my piece about Giuliani is that people would talk about the Trump campaign plane, and the only person who was like within a decade of the president's age was Giuliani. And, temperamentally, they're both kind of similarly erratic and outgoing and sometimes irrational. So that bond is a real one. Now, the president casts people out all the time, but I do think that his relationship with Giuliani, especially by Trump standards, is really an enduring one.
Yet he did have the sense to stop Giuliani from becoming Secretary of State. They saw that he would be a liability. And I kind of wonder how long it will be till they throw him under the bus in this, too.
And I guess I'm worried about that. This is going to be a brutal political fight. And I there's a fear of these, everyone who disagrees with the president is part of the deep state. For now, Chris Wray at the FBI and Gina Haspel at the CIA are functioning as they should. Democrats in Congress say the intelligence that's being produced is accurate. So all the tweeting and intimidation from the president isn't leading the intelligence community to sort of, bow to his wishes. But there's a real fear, and people see Barr as a very politicized attorney general, and that as this continues, people won't want to work for the FBI and the CIA anymore, that this campaign of the president, taking over these agencies, now the Justice Department, in the future, the FBI and CIA, that this will continue, and he will use these agencies to attack his political enemies.
A final question, Jane, for you and maybe for Jeff. Do you see congressional Republicans beginning to crack the facade of unity behind the president? So many of them are proud members of the Federalist Society, which, of course, regards itself as the protector of the Constitution.
I mean, I hate to sound so cynical, but I think it's all about the numbers and, where the public support is. And if it dips, I'm told, I've talked to a lot of people on the Hill about this, if it dips, close to 35% instead of up to 40% nationally, and if instead of having upwards of 90% of support in the Republican Party, I think you would see them peel off quickly. But right now, they see it as in their interest to stick with him.
And are basing much of their fundraising on the impeachment inquiry.
So far. I think it's very in flux, though, having watched a number of these things. It all depends how good an argument the Democrats can make and whether they can really, they have an opportunity here to convince the country. And if they do it well, I think they will shift public opinion.
But there really is, there are really two issues that I think are related, but not the same issue. The issue of impeachment is really only about what the Democratic Party is going to do in the House of Representatives, because they can impeach him and may well impeach him with no Republican votes. The other question is, will he ever be forced out of office? And the only way he gets forced out of office, either through resignation or through conviction in the Senate, is with the Republican Party really turning against him. And based on everything I've seen, the possibilities for that seem remote at best.
All right, on that somber note, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Jeffrey Toobin, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is working on a book about the Mueller investigation. Jane Mayer is The New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent and the author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. David Rode, an executive editor of NewYorker.com, is the author of In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State, forthcoming in March 2020. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.